More Than Just Words. Russell Wiebe, Felician College, Robert Dornsife, Creighton University. Language is not life. It gives life orders. Life does not speak. It listens and waits a thousand plateaus. As I rummaged through old files, I encountered the strata of my life. There was an index card from an afternoon, maybe the spring of 91. It was the day Gordon and John and Joe and I agreed to read A Thousand Plateaus. I guess we had already read the preface and decided that we would explore the claim that the book did not have to be read in chapter order. I'm trying to imagine the edginess we might have been feeling, but I can't help but laugh now to find that index card with a list of chapters in an order we somehow agreed upon. All through the winter and on through most of the spring, my mother's been in the hospital on a ventilator, a trach tube stuffed down her throat, breathing for her. She can't speak. I want to say that her words have been taken from her, but of course that is not true. It is we who have lost the sound of her voice, the words she might have spoken. The last thing I heard her say before she called me the other day was, "Get me out of this bad movie." I imagine those would be her last words to me. Just words. I think of the meaning of the word just, of all the connotations of justification, of making orderly, of giving an account of oneself, of making a straight line, of justifying the ways of God to man, and so forth. And also of all the ways the word means only or insignificantly. It was just a wrong number, say, or it was just Tuesday. I just have to go to the store. Can you just wait a minute? And so on. In The Laws of Cool, Alan Liu asks, what is the future of literature and literary study when all culture is increasingly the culture of information, and when even literary scholars subordinate literature to an apparent clone of information, cultural context? And a related question, what is the future in general of the humanities and arts when the former seems destined only for what information industries call content and the latter for multimedia entertainment? I was sitting in my house. My wife and daughter were in Florida. My daughter had just met Ariel and gotten her autograph. My dad said that my mother was wacky that day. I was thinking of plagiarism, of the core of my paper, which is simply the fallen fruit of another's plagiarism. Because I do not like to think deeply, I circle around certain images of plagiarism compulsively without ever really advancing beyond them. There's that rich poem and those photos of Levine's and the photos of her photos on the website after Sherry Levine. I was listening to songs that I had downloaded, I'll say illegally, from Napster about 6 or 7 years ago, whenever it was the rage. Perhaps I was deliberately pandering to my loneliness. I listened to a lot of songs, Richard Schindel's Shades of Grey, in which he talks about being so messed up he didn't know if he was drunk or stoned. I guess it wasn't actually his song, but Robert Earl Keane's, but I didn't listen to Keane's version, though I have it and love it. I listened to that song that I had played at my wedding, Flesh and Blood, sung by Emmy Lou and Mary Chapin Carpenter, not the Johnny Cash version I danced to, the first dance at my wedding. I've done other things like this in which I've mixed or tried to mix media. Maybe in a way I've done lots of such things. One semester I taught a class against the backdrop of bad sci-fi movies. Another time I put together a piece from overheads and an EBN tape that I learned about from a student at Lehigh. I guess these things were meant to be cool in just the way Lou means. Cool is the techno-informatic vanishing point of contemporary aesthetics, psychology, morality, politics, spirituality, and everything. No more beauty, sublimity, tragedy, grace, or evil. Only cool or not cool. He writes in the preface of that book about his wife and child. In this, my nearest network, we may not be cool, but we are warm. And however illegitimately, I feel that warmth. I'm going to name drop here and say that I met him, Alan Liu, before there was, or he was, the voice of the shuttle, either just before or just after the birth of his child. He came to speak at a conference we had at Lehigh when I was there. It was my privilege to negotiate his honoraria, to pick him up at the airport, to drive him to and from the hotel each day. I remember that he ordered 2 pieces of pie every night from room service, and that I was not clever enough to prepare an introduction, but imagined that I could do one, and did, without notes. Only as I was speaking them did I wish that I had written out the words I said. He writes of Gibson's Agrippa, and I remember the day, a Sunday, I think, after it was first released, as various hackers and cyberpunks worked themselves into a froth trying to break into the text, and the excitement when that finally happened. There was a deliciously ersatz moment when a forged William Gibson email appeared in my Lehigh mailbox. How I wish I'd saved it, announcing the opening or cracking or whatever it was that liberated that text for us to read. How it was the first time I ever felt on the inside of a techno moment, even though I knew that the email didn't really come from William Gibson. But because I had just met Alan Liu, because I had driven him to the hotel, because I had written him a thank you letter, because he had been unbelievably gracious to me, I forwarded him a copy of my bootleg Gibson text, and Liu, the real guy, not just an ersatz email, sent me a note back. We don't correspond. An appreciation of bad papers. The other day I was reading a student paper in an advanced literary criticism course. I thought the student was being a little loose with her citations. I typed one sentence from her paper into Google, and the whole paper appeared on my screen. The burning of a book arouses no sensation in me, Rich writes in a poem that I always think of when I think of plagiarism. An hour or so later, I was reading this other paper from the same class. That young woman was writing of Joyce's The Dead. About 2/3 of the way through her paper, she noticed the snow at the end of the story. It was a key symbol, she said. In the next sentence, as though to explain the snow and its meaning, she wrote, quote, "The snow is frosty." I guess I am trying to think about what it means to teach literature, to believe in the literary as a way to be in the world. Although literature, the literary, as I think both Liu and I mean, is nothing but words. Some people know that I love basketball and poems and my daughter Ava. But as the love of basketball teaches every day, not everyone loves what I love, whether it's a dunk, a deep three, a no-look pass, or just my daughter Ava wearing a crown in a picture her cousin sent me. While I think of reading this essay, I try to find a truth to offer, but there are only words. There's a book about plagiarism called Stolen Words that proves that Coleridge, among others, was a plagiarist. I noticed the convergence of my student and her sad paper about Coleridge and the rhyme. Rich's book, The Fact of a Doorframe, is dedicated for my teachers, present and gone. Because I'm here as a teacher, because plagiarism makes me think about what it means to care about words, I think of my teachers. Rich says present and gone. There's pathos in that and, as it speaks to the way her teachers, my teachers, all teachers, are both present and gone. I think of Greg Gochin discovering me in the back of an English class, applied literary criticism, on a day before I had quit drinking, before I showered on a daily basis, and before I could say much more about my literary perceptions than that I had them. He came up to me one day after class to say something. I don't remember what it was, but that gesture stretches into and out of the present, always here, always gone. And he becomes not just a teacher, but mine, my teacher. I bring him here today, not mine, but yours. Kathy Acker wrote a series of knockoff novels. One of them, Empire of the Senseless, is mostly Gibson's new romancer. But no one ever sued, and I doubt if any English teacher would have failed her either. She wonders how you could steal a word and finds the prohibition against plagiarism part of the patriarchy's claim to unitary meaning. Or there's Sherry Levine's series of photos after Edward Weston that are simply shots of Weston's photos of his own naked son. I'm sure there are hundreds of artists, poets, painters, who've thought about this conundrum of using what belongs to us all to make what only belongs to the self. I don't finally know what makes a plagiarist. My student ran out of the room when she realized I'd caught her and hasn't spoken to me since. I feel that shame, but can't teach beyond it. My little essay is not a poem. It isn't art, either. It's just some words. As Rich says, this is the oppressor's language, yet I need it to talk to you. I was thinking again of my mother. I've been speaking of her a lot this semester, and I think of all the words I thought in that hospital in Corvallis where my family spent most of Christmas. I'm a little afraid to court sympathy here. Yes, it's sad that my mother has been ill, that she'll die, if not this year, then next, or the next after that. But I wanted to speak instead of the way words, just words, provide the only and useless consolation. Of the trip I made down to a used bookstore in Corvallis to buy another copy of Eliot's The Wasteland. I don't care how much it can be seen to be riven by history. I don't care about Eliot's Anglicanism or his wife or wives or whether Pound really made the poem or how constructed my relationship to the poem might be. I don't mean that I am against theory in that way that you could be against theory when I was in graduate school. I just mean that, impossibly, I care about Eliot's words as they become mine. I guess there are some things I hope we'll meet in my essay, though they probably have nothing to do with Detroit or the virtual urban. I keep coming back to that idea of the literary. As Lou says, cultural criticism has compelled us to see every text as situated, overwritten and overdetermined by history, culture, etc. That doesn't stop me from thinking of a poem, one about my mother and the ICU, the one I'm calling Just Words. Every day I thought, today my mother is going to die. My sister called it cynical, but to me it was just the truth, just words. The air had abandoned her. While I was there, I saw my share of death's aftermath, of the dead who are maybe just beyond words. There was the speechless incredulity of the teenage girl whose mother's heart had just stopped. There was another teenage girl who became a quadriplegic in a car wreck that left her boyfriend without a scratch. My mother deserves her fate, I sometimes think. She smoked for years, went underground for years after we all thought she'd quit. But I've posed this question a dozen different ways this semester. What does it mean to get what you deserve? I guess that's not a composition question, but I keep asking it. Just words. Charles Bernstein writes, "There is a price to be paid for poetry. Its practice can poison as fatally as sniffing glue or inhaling coal dust." I saw Bill O'Reilly the night of the shooting. As he always does, he invited us into the no-spin zone. The next morning, I saw Geraldo say that the press conference was unsatisfactory. Then he called Cho a perverted madman. Because that's what I've been thinking about since my mother went in the hospital, I wondered about their words. It seems inevitable that Cho was a senior English major from South Korea. I won't be the first or last to notice the ways in which those facts play into discourses that we all know. The slightly odd but probably harmless crazy guy reading all those books on the one hand, and the resident alien. How did he get in this country? How did he get a gun? Why wasn't the campus closed? Close the borders discourse on the other. I notice these phrases, the images that recur. I think of the English major loose with two guns in the engineering building and wonder about his possible animosity. I wonder what Cho was reading or not reading, if he was working on a paper or not working on it. I'm thinking of the Keats poem, Ode on a Grecian Urn. The reason I mention Keats is that line, truth, beauty, beauty, truth, which has become a kind of emblem for me of the uninterpretable nature of words. I don't know what the line means, though I can trace it as a scholar through letters, notebooks, and monographs to its place alongside Lewes' The Laws of Cool at the end of aesthetics, to a place where beauty, truth, the language of literary appreciation gives way to cool. Like Deleuze and Guattari, Lou mentions the terrorist and the ways in which the destructive poetics of postmodernism might need to be differentiated from forms of terror. I think of a moment in one of Lou's early essays in which he speaks about the representation of the broken back of a cat in Darnton's narrative and his troubled and troubling attempt to account for the way that broken back cries out across the literary representation of it. Lou writes, "In Robert Darnton's essay on the Great Cat Massacre, the most disturbing detail is the killing of the Grease, the favorite cat of the master printer's wife. We hear in our inner ear the brittle, wet breaking of the gray's spine as the iron bar, wielded by a subversive apprentice, descends. We see in our inner eye the convulsions of the beast as an accomplice finishes the deed. But that is not what is finally disturbing. What stays with us in the mind as well as in the viscera, what lingers is the facility with which the victim of violence becomes a symbol. I imagine a discourse, but perhaps that cannot be the word. I try to imagine another, a something else beyond or before the language of representation. I think of that moment in Keats' poem, "Thou Still Unravished Bride of Quietness." I wonder about the way the word still seems to point beyond itself to the tragic inaction of the literary. I want to think that there is a kind of heroism in that inaction, that it might represent the moment of thought that precedes terror. But instead I say, at last, or still, or even so. No doubt I could multiply the synonyms, broaden the context of that stillness that feels like the center of the poem. One continues to act, I want to say, even in stillness, although one has nothing but words, or just words, and so nothing at all. I suppose I would say that thematically Keats' poem opposes the human order and the eternal order, though perhaps I would also say that this opposition is tenuous. That last line, beauty, truth, truth, beauty, seems to be an aesthetic value. We know truth through beauty. In a letter to Benjamin Bailey, Keats, the actual guy, writes, "I am certain of nothing but of the holiness of the heart's affection and the truth of the imagination. What the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth." But I have to say, this bugs me. First, we all know it isn't so. The true is not beautiful. The beautiful not necessarily true. All of our lives demonstrate the falsity of this proposition every day. Of course, we also understand that the claim is for an order of truth and beauty that is somehow transcendental, not the everyday ugly truth of pipe bombs in mailboxes or suicide bombings in Jerusalem. True truth, beauteous beauty, truth that lasts forever, beauty that never fades because it's never quite in the world. I bring together a series of anecdotes, little narratives, and try to make sense of them. What else can one do when 33 are dead in Blacksburg, Virginia, in a real no-spin zone? By the day I read this piece, perhaps more will have died in Virginia. My mother may be dead, or remain on the ventilator, or have been weaned. There's a moment in 1,000 Plateaus in which Deleuze and Guattari speak of the hijacker. It connects us to terror, to the discourse of terrorism, though perhaps not to real or genuine terror, the Platonic ideal of towers falling, of airplanes crashing into buildings made not of words, but of steel. I think of the way that Derrida both is, just is, dead, and isn't. We know his words, his thoughts, his place in discourses that bear and revile his name, which remain alive, though just words, however improper. I don't think I'm profound when I say that this is all just words, that my mother, all of us, live in the beyond of language. Here's a quote from one of Cho's classmates. "When we read Cho's plays, it was like something out of a nightmare. The plays had really twisted, macabre violence that used weapons I wouldn't have even thought of. Before Cho got to class that day, we students were talking to each other with serious worry about whether he could be a school shooter. I was even thinking of scenarios of what I would do in case he did come in with a gun. I was that freaked out about him." When the students gave reviews of his play in class, we were very careful with our words in case he decided to snap. I have to say that I read those plays, Richard McBeef, Mr. Brownstone, and they didn't strike me as scarily violent. The guy at whom the chainsaw is brandished deserves it in the logic of the piece, and he, not the boy, is the murderer. And I think of other pieces I've read, revealing essays and stories that students wrote in contexts I created. I think of a girl in the first class I ever taught who wrote of her nymphomania, or of students who wrote stories in which the main character killed him or herself or someone else, or even a lot of someone else's. A woman named Kimberly Lacey, a teaching assistant at Wayne State, is quoted as writing, "As a human, I'm deeply saddened and afraid thinking about this event, but as an instructor, I'm not sure how to react." Perhaps we notice the way she sets up that distinction. As a human, she is saddened. As an instructor, no longer only, still, or just human, just unsure, not a robot, not without feeling, but an instructor. And we recognize that moment. On another blog I read, someone wrote, "Given all the emphasis on Cho's creative writing, I'd guess student fiction writers will be feeling the heat. Turning in dark, tortured, soul-searching fiction will be a good way to get sent to a counselor or wind up interviewed by the local police." I hear that line. We were very careful with our words in case he decided to snap. And I think of Darnton's cat, the snap as the back breaks, and the cat's lived pain, not just words, but dead, as just a point in a dialogue or discourse, just representation, just words.